So it's been 2 weeks since we met last, because of the rain. And I assume that, tell me if I'm wrong, since all of you are such avid students of Savitri, and you've had 2 weeks to prepare, I suppose that everyone has read the Book of Fate since the last time.
Seems.
Right? Am I right?
Wrong assumption.
just like my high school students every day, huh?
You never said we were.
No, but if you must know at your age. That you get out of something what you put into it. So what have you been doing for the last 2 weeks? I've read the Book of Fate twice in the last 2 weeks. So you're just waiting for me to do all the work. Okay, is everyone sufficiently embarrassed now?
Yeah, well, you know what I did, like, the Book of Fate, last evening, I put it in my ear and I went to bed and sleep with it.
No, well, I'm sure that does a lot of good.
Yes, it does a lot of good.
So, children, let me tell you that Savitri is about transformation. This is not television. And if you're not working with it yourself, it's not, what I'm doing is not going to be anything more than a one-hour show. So, I mean, if that's what you want, okay, I'm here. I'll give you a one-hour show. No charge. It's free. But what I would like to be able to do is to ask you.
I would like 48 hours a day.
So how many lifetimes is it going to take you until you decide that Savitri is a priority?
Oh, I go every Sunday morning since 7 years to the Savitri study circle. Even my English was not good, so I do and read at home. So and I translate it. So I spend quite.
So you've read this book?
No,
the Book of Fate.
I didn't read this
book. This is called the Book of Fate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shaping the Fate. I've read it many times.
Good. So this book is basically the opposite of what we heard in the last hour. Yes, absolutely.
Especially in those passages where Narada describes how the soul takes a decision to come down, the whole creation.
Okay, this is my presentation. This book is the opposite of what we heard in the last hour. And if that teaching which we heard in the last hour had been capable of transforming the evil dream, then it would have already done so.
It is doing it.
But it is not doing it, and it cannot do it, and it will never do it. So the reason why Sri Aurobindo wrote this book and this poem is because that will never transform anything. I'm sorry, but that's why he wrote this book. And we will hear tonight very, very explicitly the most explicit statement that Sri Aurobindo made in his life about the nature of existence. This is Sri Aurobindo's view of the world as it exists and why it exists the way it is.
And it's absolutely Vedic. One-to-one
imagination. Yes, it is Vedic, but it is the other side of the story. And the uniqueness of this teaching is that it does not dwell on the luminous, eternal, overmind truths. Sri Aurobindo's teaching dwells on life and matter and why and how it must change. That's the significance of Sri Aurobindo and of Savitri. And that's the difference between his yoga and the Vedic teaching. Those luminous planes are there, they have always been there, and they will always be there. But there is there. And here is here. So this book, which has two cantos in it, is a number of different things, all of which are important. In terms of Savitri, this book doesn't require any interpretation, or, as we've been seeing in the last couple of sessions, an attempt to understand the relationship between Savitri and Satyavan, or Aswapati and ourselves and yoga, and that kind of effort to imagine why Savitri would descend into an aspiring being and make transformation possible, which is the story that has been going on. This book is what it is. It states explicitly what it means. And as such, it is Sri Aurobindo's boldest and most explicit statement of his worldview. It's also the quintessential epic dramatic form. In these two books, Sri Aurobindo brings to an absolute peak of perfection his poetic style, which, as we explained in the first series, is an adaptation of the epic and dramatic classical form to a new kind of spiritual poetry, where the innermost truths of things are given a voice. So in this case, fate, whatever we may think that means, we will certainly hear what it means tonight. And It is given a number of, it's given four voices. So Sri Aurobindo shows us in the most explicit way through epic, dramatic voice the meaning, the innermost meaning of the term and the concept of fate. There is nothing vague about this. It is extremely explicit and upfront and powerful and direct. So we will hear from Sri Aurobindo the meaning of the word fate and all of its shades of meaning that he apparently feels will help us understand something profound. He is not playing around in this book. He is exposing an innermost secret of our existence regarding time and destiny and the reason why things are the way they are. For him, existence has a meaning, and the way things are has a purpose. And this is the hardest aspect of Sri Aurobindo's teaching, the most difficult to assimilate. And as Paul would be happy to acknowledge, this is the Gnostic gospel. This is the teaching of Gnosticism. What it really meant, and what it still really means. You know, there was a period in... There was a period in the development of Christian mysticism during which a heroic attempt was made to come to terms with the world as it is and to understand the light of Christ in the context of pain and suffering. So Gnosticism was, there was an effort made during the history of the evolution of the human spirit before now, probably many times before now, to understand this mystery of existence. So this is Sri Aurobindo's ultimate... Well, whatever, Margaret, whatever you have understood is perfectly fine. And what we're going to understand tonight is what Sri Aurobindo has to say. So you might want to hold up your understanding to this flaming truth and see whether it survives or not. One of the things that Sri Aurobindo is quite capable of doing is helping us to improve our understanding of things, especially when he chooses to dwell upon something like this to such an extent. This is, for us to spend a couple of weeks dwelling on something like this is nothing in relation to what it really is that we're trying to understand. So the difference between using the epic and dramatic form for Sri Aurobindo to use it to express these truths and what we normally think and read in other writers is that Sri Aurobindo has the power to transmit directly to consciousness the truth itself of this world and the aspect of this world known as fate. So there is nothing left to interpret. So here we go. I'm going to read some passages throughout these two books and make a minimum number of observations regarding the theme and structure of this book. What we've been doing is going through book by book the whole of Savitri. So we've come to this book 6. And books 6 and 7 are extremely important for us, apart from the poem, because they deal with our existence and what we have to do to change it yogically, 6 and 7. So this is the problem and the solution, 6 and 7. So the beginning of this canto is a beautiful description of the descent of a divine rishi through the plains down to earth, where he meets the mother and father of Savitri and Savitri. And she has just returned from meeting Satyavan. And so Narad, the heavenly sage, addresses Savitri immediately with a long speech that shows that he has seen everything that has happened. But he's here to clarify her mission. So the first thing that he says gives us the beginning of an indication of this term. Oh, by the way, the title of it is The Word of Fate. That means fate's word. It's a genitive. Fate's word. So Sri Aurobindo couldn't possibly make that any clearer. So I'm going to go to page 420. Uh-oh, I don't have a single page here. I've got double pages up. How do I get the... Single page? No, I want single page.
This is the
No, no, but the other page is to the right of it, over here. I'm going from 19, and the next page is 21. I'm missing page 20. Let's let Sri Aurobindo tell us. Yeah. So he's going to say that in two or three different ways. But there's the way he says it doesn't make light of it at all. It's not as if, oh, that's what it's about, so that's what we're going to say. Sri Aurobindo is going to allow us to understand what the significance of this is in our lives. This is not about the story of Savitri and Satipan.
That story is also not about that story.
Right. So here's the first indication that we get. He speaks to Savitri in the beginning of this canto. O thou who hast come to this great perilous world, now only seen through the splendor of thy dreams, where hardly love and beauty can live safe, thyself a being dangerously great, a soul alone in a golden house of thought has lived walled in by the safety of thy dreams on heights of happiness, leaving doom asleep, who hunts unseen the unconscious lives of men. In thy heart, if thy heart could live, locked in the ideal's gold, as high, as happy might thy waking be. If for all time doom could be left to sleep. He spoke, but held his knowledge back from words, as a cloud plays with lightning's vivid laugh, but still holds back the thunder in its heart. Only he let bright images escape. His speech, like glimmering music, veiled his thoughts, as a wind flatters the bright summer air, pitiful to mortals. Only to them it spoke of living beauty and of present bliss. He hid in his all-knowing mind the rest. Then the next speech is the speech of Aswapati. Who has a keen ear, he understands the implications. This is the sattvic view. Ashwapati is the Raja Yogi, the father of Savitri, the knower of everything. If but this joy of life could last, if but this joy of life could last, nor pain throw its bronze note into her rhythmed days. Behold her, singer with the prescient gaze, and let thy blessing chant that this fair child shall pour the nectar of a sorrowless life around her from her lucid heart of love. Heal with her bliss the tired breast of earth, and cast like a happy snare felicity, as grows the great and golden bounteous tree, flowering by Alakananda's murmuring waves, where, with enamored speed, the waters run, lisping and babbling to the splendor of morn, and cling with lyric laughter round the knees of heaven's daughters, dripping magic rain, pearl bright from moon-gold limbs and cloudy hair. So are her dawns, like jeweled leaves of light, so casts she her felicity on men. A flame of radiant happiness she was born, and surely will that flame set earth alight. Doom surely will see her pass and say no word. Doom surely will see her pass and say no word. But too often here, the careless mother leaves her chosen in the envious hands of fate. The harp of God falls mute. Its call to bliss, discouraged, fails mid earth's unhappy sounds. The strings of the siren ecstasy cry not here, or soon are silenced in the human heart. Of sorrow's songs we have enough. Bid once her glad and griefless days bring heaven here, or must fire always test the great of soul? Along the dreadful causeway of the gods, armored with love and faith and sacred joy, a traveler to the eternal's house, once let unwounded pass a mortal life. But Narad answered not. silent he sat, knowing that words are vain and fate is Lord. He looked into the unseen with seeing eyes. Then, dallying with the mortal's ignorance, like one who knows not, questioning, he cried, "On what high mission went her hastening wheels? Whence came she with this glory in her heart and paradise made visible in her eyes? What sudden God has met? What face supreme?" Let's recall for a minute the question about the divinity of Savitri in this statement of Aswapati. The red Ashoka watched her going forth, which now sees her return. Arisen into an air of flaming dawn, like a bright bird tired of her lonely branch to find her own Lord, since to her on earth he came not yet. This sweetness wandered forth, cleaving her way with the beat of her rapid wings. Led by a distant call, her vague, swift flight threaded the summer morns and sunlit lands. The happy rest her burdened lashes keep, and these charmed guardian lips hold treasured still. Virgin who comest, perfected by joy, reveal the name thy sudden heartbeats learn. Whom hast thou chosen, kingliest among men? So she says that she has met Satyavan, son of Dhyumatsena. She has carried out the will of Aswapati. She has found her destined human counterpart. And Aswapati then speaks. I'm going to this line here. Well, the reason why I just read that intermediate passage, that transitional passage, which has her flying into the dawn and crossing all the lands until she finds Satyavan, and all of those cantos that we've read in the last 3 weeks have indicated that it's never absolutely clear on what plane this is happening. Sri Aurobindo's art is to keep it open. Sometimes it's clearly spiritual, and sometimes it's clearly on the earth plane, and sometimes, as when Satyavan sees her, he can't figure it out. I made a point of reading that line a few times last time. He wasn't sure whether this was a divine being or a creature of the earth, and he demanded to her, only if you can come down and enjoy drinking a cup of tea with me, am I interested in you, because I've already seen all the gods, and they haven't done anything particularly for my state. So hold that question. Don't answer it. Keep it open for the whole rest of the book. And when we get to the end, when we get to the end of everlasting day, you will be certain of the answer.
So then it's like a new step of conscious experience, or like even you down in another one. Before right. It was joy and felicity. She was poor. She was gnostic. But then comes another challenge, a new growth of consciousness, and she has to fall down again, and has to recover this gnostic way again.
So let's try and hold on to the idea of fate for this class, because the revelation of the idea of fate is what it's about. And here we get another quick, just right after she says that she has done what she was sent to do, Father, I have chosen. This is done. Everyone's astonished. Then Aswapati looked within and saw a heavy shadow float above the name. Chased by a sudden and stupendous light, this is the whole theme in one line. He looked into his daughter's eyes and spoke. Well hast thou done, and I approve thy choice. If this is all, then all is surely well. If there is more, then all can still be well. Whether it seem good or evil to men's eyes, only for good the secret will can work. Our destiny is written in double terms. Whether it seem evil or good in men's eyes, only for good the secret will can work. Our destiny is written in double terms. Through nature's contraries, we draw nearer God. Out of the darkness, we still grow to light. Death is our road to immortality. That's the sattvic voice. But now the queen, alarmed, lifted her voice. She has been listening to all of this. And what does she represent?
Narada has to say this word of faith.
Well,
the queen objects to his word, not to this word was said. You have to mention that.
He doesn't say it yet.
It says, otherwise queen didn't say it.
No, no, she's just listening to the implications so far. He will say it, but he hasn't said it yet. O seer, thy bright arrival has been timed to this high moment of a happy life. Then let the speech benign of griefless spheres confirm this blithe conjunction of two stars and sanction joy with thy celestial voice. Here drag not in the peril of our thoughts. Let not our words create the doom they fear. Here is no cause for dread, no chance for grief, to raise her ominous head and stare at love. A single spirit in a multitude, happy is Satyavan mid earthly men, whom Savitri has chosen for her mate, and fortunate the forest hermitage, where, leaving her palace and riches, and a throne, my Savitri will dwell and bring in heaven. Then let thy blessing put the immortal seal on these bright lives, unstained felicity, pushing the ominous shadow from their days. Too heavy falls a shadow on man's heart. It dares not be too happy upon earth. If wings of evil brood above that house, then also speak, that we may turn aside and rescue our lives from hazard of wayside doom and chance entanglement of an alien fate. So she is the purely vital, emotional mother voice saying, we still, if it's not going to work out right, we still have time to change it. But let us know now. Stop talking about light and shadow. So then we get a very bold statement. This is God's view in response to the mother. Narad is from that plane. What help is in prevision to the driven? What help is in prevision to the driven? Safe doors cry, opening near, the doomed pass on. A future knowledge is an added pain, a torturing burden, and a fruitless light on the enormous scene that fate has built. The eternal poet, universal mind, has paged each line of his imperial act. Invisible, the giant actors tread, and man lives like some secret player's mask. He knows not even what his lips shall speak. For a mysterious power compels his steps, and life is stronger than his trembling soul. None can refuse what the stark force demands. Her eyes are fixed upon her mighty aim. No cry or prayer can turn her from her path. She has leaped an arrow from the bow of God. His words were theirs who live unforced to grieve and help by calm the swaying wheels of life and the long restlessness of transient things and the trouble and passion of the unquiet world. So we get the God view, and then we get the mother view again, the human mortal mother view. As though her own bosom were pierced, the mother saw the ancient human sentence strike her child. Her sweetness that deserved another fate, only a larger measure given of tears. Aspiring to the nature of the gods, a mind proof armored, mailed in mighty thoughts, a will entire, couchant behind wisdom's shield, though to still heavens of knowledge she had risen, though calm and wise and Aswapati's queen, human was she still, and opened her doors to grief. So the response of the human soul to the word of fate, that hard word, she speaks. Let's see if we can identify with this speech. What stealthy doom has crept across her path, emerging from the dark forest's sullen heart? What evil thing stood smiling by the way and wore the beauty of the Shalwa boy? Perhaps he came an enemy from her past, armed with a hidden force of ancient wrongs, himself unknowing, and seized her unknown. Here, dreadfully entangled, love and hate meet us, blind wanderers mid the perils of time. Our days are links of a disastrous chain. Necessity avenges casual steps. Old cruelties come back unrecognized. The gods make use of our forgotten deeds. Yet all in vain, the bitter law was made. Our own minds are the justicers of doom. For nothing have we learned, but still repeat our stark misuse of self and others' souls. There are dire alchemies of the human heart, and fallen from his ethereal element, love darkens to the spirit of nether gods, the dreadful angel, angry with his joys, woundingly sweet, he cannot yet forego, is pitiless to the soul his gaze disarmed. He visits with his own pangs his quivering prey, forcing us to cling enamored to his grip as if in love with our own agony. This is one poignant misery in the world, and grief has other lassos for our life. Our sympathies become our torturers. Strength have I, my own punishment to bear, knowing it just, but on this earth perplexed, smitten in the sorrow of scourged and helpless things, often it faints to meet other suffering eyes. We are not as the gods who know not grief and look impassive on a suffering world. Calm they gaze down on the little human scene and the short-lived passion crossing mortal hearts. An ancient tale of woe can move us still. We keep the ache of breasts that breathe no more. We are shaken by the sight of human pain and share the miseries that others feel. Ours not the passionless lids that cannot age. Too hard for us is heaven's indifference. Our own tragedies are not enough for us. All pathos and all sufferings we make ours. We have sorrow for a greatness passed away and feel the touch of tears in mortal things. Even a stranger's anguish rends my heart. And this, O Narad, is my well-loved child. Hide not from us our doom, if doom is ours. This is the worst, an unknown face of fate, a terror ominous, mute, felt more than seen, behind our seat by day, our couch by night. A fate lurking in the shadow of our hearts, the anguish of the unseen that waits to strike. To know is best, however hard to bear. But we can't. That's the thing about fate. We can't know. And it does strike. And we do suffer. This is the mortal perspective. But she fell from that just now. She was there, and this news shook her.
They have not faith in the divine, that everything is possible when the divine touches them.
Even the divine can feel pain.
Yes, of course. But you come out.
Then cried the sage, piercing the mother's heart. This is the divine response. No, it's on this page. This was the last thing. Then cried the sage, piercing the mother's heart, forcing to steal the will of Savitri. So fate has different effects on different people. Depending on their destiny. Then cried the sage, piercing the mother's heart, forcing to steal the will of Savitri, his words set free the spring of cosmic fate. The great gods use the pain of human hearts as a sharp axe to hew their cosmic road. They squander lavishly men's blood and tears for a moment's purpose in their fateful work. This cosmic nature's balance is not ours, nor the mystic measure of her need and use. This cosmic nature's balance is not ours, nor the mystic measure of her need and use. A single word lets loose vast agencies. Well, not my word and not your word, but some people's words. A single word lets loose vast agencies. A casual act determines the world's fate. So now he set free destiny in that hour. The truth thou hast claimed, I give to thee the truth. A marvel of the meeting earth and heavens is he whom Savitri has chosen mid men. His figure is the front of nature's march. His single being excels the works of time. A sapphire cutting from the sleep of heaven, delightful is the soul of Satyavan, a ray out of the rapturous infinite, a silence waking to a hymn of joy, a divinity and kingliness gird his brow. His eyes keep a memory from a world of bliss, as brilliant as a lonely moon in heaven, gentle like the sweet bud that spring desires, pure like a stream that kisses silent banks. He takes with bright surprise spirit and sense. O loss, if death into its elements, of which his gracious envelope was built, shatter this vase before it breathes its sweets. As if earth could not keep too long from heaven a treasure thus unique, loaned by the gods, a being so rare, of so divine a make. In one brief year, when this bright hour flies back and perches careless on a branch of time, this sovereign glory ends, heaven lent to earth. This splendor vanishes from the mortal sky. Heaven's greatness came, but was too great to stay. Heaven's greatness came, but was too great to stay. 12 swift-winged months are given to him and her. This day returning, Satyavan must die. Well, we can imagine what the queen has to say to that. Vain then can be heaven's grace. Heaven marks us with the brilliance of its gifts, for death is a cupbearer of the wine of too brief joy, held up to mortal lips for a passionless moment by the careless gods. But I reject the grace and the mockery. Okay, rejection. That's what we do when faced with fate. That's the typical mortal response to that kind of knowledge.
I think
reject it.
Not to face in better way, and that's in this place has to be nourished or has to be understood. Because Satyagraha later also got
But then there's the opposite response, which comes from Savitri herself. She's heard everything that her mother has heard, and so there is another response to fate, which is possible. This is the soul's response, not the heart's, and not the mind's, and not the God's. This is the fourth response. My will is part of the eternal will. My fate is what my spirit's strength can make. My fate is what my spirit's strength can bear. My strength is not the Titans, it is God's. I have discovered my glad reality beyond my body in another's being. I have found the deep, unchanging soul of love. Then how shall I desire a lonely good? Or slay, aspiring to white, vacant peace, the endless hope that made my soul spring forth out of its infinite solitude and sleep? My spirit has glimpsed the glory for which it came. The beating of one vast heart in the flame of things. My eternity clasped by his eternity and tireless of the sweet abysms of time. Deep possibility always to love. This is first, last joy, and to its throb the riches of 1,000 fortunate years are poverty. Nothing to me are death and grief, or ordinary lives and happy days. And what to me are common souls of men, or eyes and lips that are not Satyavan's? I have no need to draw back from his arms and the discovered paradise of his love, and journey into a still infinity. Only now, for my soul in Satyavan, I treasure the rich occasion of my birth in sunlight and a dream of emerald waves. I shall walk with him like gods in paradise, if for a year, that year is all my life. And yet I know this is not all my fate, only to live and love a while and die. For I know now why my spirit came on earth, and who I am and who he is I love. I have looked at him from my immortal self. I have seen God smile at me in Satyavan. I have seen the eternal in a human face. So I want to just do the top of this page, the next canto, and I'll finish this canto next time, because the book of yoga takes one day, but the book of death takes no time at all. In fact, we won't even do it. It'll be part of the book of yoga because it's nothing. So we can take up some time by skipping that one. And I'll just read the entrance to this canto. A silence sealed the irrevocable decree. The word of fate that fell from heavenly lips, fixing a doom no power could ever reverse, unless heaven's will itself could change its course. Or so it seemed. Yet from the silence rose one voice that questioned changeless destiny. A will that strove against the immutable will. She just won't give up. She'll continue rebelling against this will till the end of time, because we must rebel against this will of fate unless we know its purpose, unless we feel its purpose. It is not tolerable. It is not acceptable to the human being. This doctrine of fate is unacceptable. To the mortal. And so we don't even want to talk about it. We don't want to hear about it. Fate, what is that? That's some belief which the ancients had. It's not even a word in our vocabulary anymore, because we can't bear it. A mother's heart had heard the fateful speech that rang like a sanction to the call of death, and came like a chill close to life and hope. Yet hope sank down like an extinguished fire. She felt the leaden, inevitable hand. invade the secrecy of her guarded soul and smite with sudden pain its still content. And the empire of her hard-won quietude. So even the mother of Savitri, the mate of Aswapati, in her absolute yogic perfection, can feel smitten before the realization of the real meaning of doom. Doom. This is the reality that Savitri is incarnating to face. The spirit of Savitri is not anymore in heaven with the gods. The Vedic Savitri is no more there. If Savitri has any meaning, it is to face this reality of destruction and keep its integrity, which even the queen of Aswapati cannot do. Yoga is not enough for this reality.
But for him, Aswapati, it's possible.
She felt the leaden, inevitable hand invade the secrecy of her guarded soul and smite with sudden pain its still content and the empire of her hard-won quietude. A while she fell to the level of human mind, a field of mortal grief, and nature's law. She shared, she bore the common lot of men and felt what common hearts endure in time. Just a quick reference to the theme of the next canto. It's not quite the same. There is something that runs throughout Savitri. There's a long speech of the queen here, which is the complete statement of Sri Aurobindo's worldview, which we'll read next time. It's 2 pages. But here's a line which occurs in it. He calls heaven's retribution on his head and wallows in his self-made misery, a part author of the cosmic tragedy. His will conspires with death and time and fate. Death and time and fate, the cosmic tragedy.
Is it spoken of normal life? Yes. This is, in a sense, this is, meaning is the average man.
This is the state even of the yogi. This is why Aswapati does his tapasya, because even for him, even for Sri Aurobindo and the mother, even for all of us, it still comes down to the tragedy of time. As long as there is death, and as long as our fate is death, this existence is a cosmic tragedy. It's not a comedy. And if we go back all the way, this occurs many, this juxtaposition of tragedy and time occurs throughout Savitri. It is a recurring formula of Sri Aurobindo. So if we look at page 75, for example, right in the first book, bottom of page 75, you'll remember these lines. This is Aswapati, right after his first realization. Once more was heard in the still cosmic mind. This is the yogic consciousness. The Eternal's promise to his laboring force, inducing the world passion to begin. The cry of birth into mortality and the opening verse of the tragedy of time. From the beginning, and evermore. The essence of time is change. Nothing lasts. Only if there is a possibility of a consciousness that is not subject to time is it possible to experience existence as bliss. Everything in existence dies, suffers, experiences pain. And it's for a purpose. The nature of time, the tragedy of time, exists for a purpose. It's supposed to be that way. It's intended from the beginning. Because without it, there cannot be bliss. That's the theme of the second canto, and that is the Gnostic Gospel.
The mother is differentiating between the Ananda, which is out of the manifestation, and the Ananda, which is participating in the unending evolution. So, I mean, if we can get this connection to the Ananda in both ways, yeah, then time is no more tragedy. The time will be experienced as a joyful unfolding. So, in so far, you are right that we have to go through that to go there. We have to experience the pain to get fed up with the pain and go beyond the pain.
But there is also, in the previous passage we read, this word co-author. So we are the co-author.
Yeah, that's the that whole next passage which I'm going to read, which I said is Sri Aurobindo's worldview. He states it in the two or three different places, almost the same way. But that's the most complete statement, is the one which comes at the beginning of Canto 2, the way of fate and the problem of pain.
Yeah. When we are no more in this human littleness, then we are not co-authors of
the Well, no, the significance of it is that we choose this because the divine chose this, because we knew at some point that suffering was the way to bliss, just as the divine knew that a cosmos made of time and tragedy was necessary for the manifestation of bliss. So he says in several different places, don't complain about this, you knew it all the time. It was your choice from the beginning. So I'll read a few of those passages next time.
Because we identify with the creation as it is, so we have accepted to come down in this suffering world.
So the message is, stop rejecting it.
We can't reject.
Realize that this is the way, this is the path, this is the way of pain, pain's way. That's the meaning of the title of this canto. Pain's way is the way to transformation and immortality. And there is no other way.
The mother speaks of the sunlit path, yeah? The pure in soul can walk in light. As when we are not bound by human littleness, yeah, and desires and ignorance, yeah, if we really totally surrender, yeah, we don't need to walk.
But in order to be totally surrendered, you have to cut all of the attachments and give up pain.
The mother says, don't search for the pain. The pain will come automatically.
Yeah, it does all the time.
So if the pain comes, okay, offer it up. But it doesn't mean that we all the time have to go through pain. No.
There is a possibility, but she says, few can tread the sunlit path.
So,
and in that line, the word few is very significant. It's not being prescribed. It's that there are a few who are able to do that because of what they have accomplished. But anybody who thinks that that's going to be easy to do, and that everyone should just find the sunlit path right away, is grossly misreading the teaching. Because the teaching is that the fastest way to bliss is through death and pain and suffering. And we will hear that again and again in this canto that's coming up.
the ocean more than earth. So we have to purify all the different tribulations of beings. Then we evoke in light and peace and joy.
But here's the key is right here. You know, in his absolute silent mind, the yogi sees that the eternal has enticed life into being, into mortality. Because that is the way. Mortality is the way. Tragedy is the way. Time is not possible without it. And it might be interesting to point out that this term, the tragedy of time, is one that Nietzsche has several passages in Zarathustra and in other places where he uses this term in exactly this way. It's a perception that he also shared. The Superman is possible only as a result of this abyss. And so Nietzsche says, why do you hesitate to jump into the abyss and the flame? Because that's the way to the Superman. And he's fed up with those who want to have everything nicely boxed and agreed upon and universally accepted and diluted into something which is acceptable. Canto 2 next time.